Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on a big step!
Oh,
brother! Lead Toledo artist. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead!
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me as always is Rich Craich. And joining us today is a first-time guest. He is a professor of history who writes about the NBA, including at our he's a contributor at our forums at overandbacknba.com, Adam Cribbley. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to go back a little old school. For the most part, for the individual player discussions, we have been talking about post-1996 players. But there's a few players who played before that era that we think were overlooked and are deserving of a deeper dive. And one of them today is Adrian Dantley. So going through a little bit of just the overall numbers for him, he is 33rd all-time in win shares, 27th in win shares for 48, 58th in box score plus-minus, 40th in value over replacement player. He is a two-time All-NBA second team. He had seven seasons in the top 10 in win shares for 48, including number one in 1984, five times in the top 10 in value over replacement player. In other ranking systems, he is 66th in the Bill Simmons Book of Basketball Pyramid, and the Slam Magazine Top 500 has him at 83rd. And he was an incredibly efficient, productive scorer in an era where efficiency wasn't really as valued. Incredible getting at the free throw line, just had a great footwork and a great touch. Really great scorer, but maybe not a strong defender. Sometimes had issues on teams. He was traded a lot, and teams often played better after he left. So seems like, just based on the numbers, seems like an absolute, you know, great superstar and be a shoo-in for this top 50. But with some of the other stuff, maybe not so much. Clearly, it was overlooked on the original list. So there's something there that you know maybe is questionable. So, Adam, how do you feel about Adrian Dantley and his case for the top 50?
You know, I didn't know a lot about Dantley other than kind of his late career when he was on those Pistons teams, and of course, famously is traded to Dallas, and Detroit brings in Mark McGwire, and then they win a title. And so you very much have this idea of addition by subtraction. Like he was obviously not that good, or Detroit wouldn't have traded him, and you know he would have won a title in Detroit. So before I did any any research or really knew much about Dantley, that was kind of all I knew about him. And so it's been really fun to kind of dig into the numbers and really look at how productive of a player he was. And as you mentioned, especially in the days before we looked at things like player efficiency and box plus minus.
Yeah, one thing I just noticed that was interesting is from 1980 to 1984, so five seasons in a row, he had PERs of 24.3, 24.3, 24.2, 24.4, and 24.6.
It would have been nice if he would have been a little more consistent.
Yeah, what's funny is have you looked at his points per game during that same era? I'm looking at it right now, 30.7, 30.3, 30.7, and then 30.6. So, yeah, he just really across the board. I mean, guy, you just could not predict what he was going to do year to year.
Right.
It's just, got to be frustrating for teams. You know, the Utah Jazz looking to get together. Like, what are we going to get out of Dantley this year?
Yeah.
30 points per game. I mean, come on. Out of nowhere.
Yeah, and he was reputed, if you look at the videotape, kind of did the same thing. I mean, he either like, you know, kind of got the ball and, you know, and took a shot like sort of a flat footed jumper, like, you know, from the top of the key, kind of mid range thing, or he would, you know, kind of fake a guy out and get around to the basket and sort of, you know, sneak a layup by somebody. Like he wasn't necessarily that quick, but like just maybe like somewhat in similar in style to, you know, a Paul Pierce, where he could just, you know, he was crafty enough to kind of get around you and to kind of use what he had to, you know, hit some good fakes and just was able to, you know, either, you know, draw a foul or, you know, just kind of sneak to the basket around other guys. And, you know, was also incredibly disciplined, and Joe Dumars called him the most disciplined player that he'd ever seen. So, I mean, numbers wise, he's absolutely, you know, seems like he should be there. And, you know, he led some pretty good Utah teams. He was sort of traded. They did kind of get better after he left, but that was, I think, more of like that kind of gave Stockton and Malone room to breathe rather than necessarily him being worse. And, you know, even though Detroit did, I mean, they won a championship after he left, but, you know, he was 32 and really at the end of his career. I mean, he only played like 65 or 55 more games, or I don't know, 80 more games, I guess. So not that many more games after that, over a couple more seasons. So he was basically done at that point. And, you know, he got them to a point where, you know, when he joined them, they were like, you know, pretty good playoff team, but they weren't winning championships. And he got them to within one game winning the finals. So close enough, I would say, to being a guy who could lead you to a championship. Now, they, you know, had Isaiah Thomas and Bill Laimbeer, and, you know, he wasn't necessarily the best player on those teams, but he was still, you know, very, very good.
You know, I was when I was watching some video clips of him, kind of I like the Paul Pierce comparison, but I went a little old school for my comparison, and I was looking at his game, and he played so much without kind of the court vision of kind of an Oscar Robertson. And so, I mean, it's a completely bizarre comparison, because Dantley was obviously more of a pure scorer and Robertson a floor general, but their body types were similar. I mean, they were both kind of chiseled 6'5", 210 pounders. And one thing I loved watching about, you know, watching Oscar and reading about Oscar was that he never jumped an inch higher than he had to. He never, you know, people would think they could block his shot and they would, it would just pass their fingertips. And on layups, he'd get post position against someone you just didn't expect he could score on, and he still would. And Dantley was the same way. I mean, he was, you know, a 6'3 or 6'4 forward who scored around the hoop. And he kind of had that, like you mentioned with Pierce, he kind of had an old man game that I can only imagine would have translated real well to the YMCA or whatever, you know, in a later age. But he just played so differently than anybody else in the league at the time, or really since, with the exception, again, Pierce is maybe the best modern comparison, and Pierce is still 5 or 6 inches taller.
Yeah, a guy that I use that is interesting, it's kind of interesting, we all came with different ones, and I think we all have different sort of scopes of it, is I called him the rich man's Corey Maggette.
I like that.
A lot of ways. Whereas as Corey, I mean, obviously he's far better than Corey Maggette, but similar thing where Corey Maggette's just, you know, he walked onto the court in this body, you know, chiseled, and you're like, oh, this guy is just going to jump all over us, run us down. And then he's kind of like slow, and he kind of backs you down, and then he goes to the line like 15 times and scores 20 points, you know, mostly at the free throw line. But that's just kind of how he did it. And that's I get the same thing from Dantley as well, where you always kind of assume, looking at his body, oh man, this guy is just going to be super athletic and fly all over the court and do all this sort of stuff. And it's like, nah, I'm just going to kind of be, I'm going to back you down, even though you're taller than me. But that's all right. I'm just going to kind of not even jump and make a little kind of turnaround jumper. It's funny. I mean, watching the clips of him, you sort of see this. It's almost like you look at it and you go, how is this guy as good as he is? You know, and a lot of stuff. And then you look at the numbers and you go, holy crap, this guy's really, really good. And it's you know, as I'm going through and pouring through these numbers and looking at him and doing stuff and watching these game films, and I'm looking at him going, he's one of the more underrated guys I think I've ever seen. Whereas a guy who just production wise, it's all there. I mean, like everything you could ask for is there. But for some reason, we didn't initially think of him as a shoe-in for the top 50. You know, obviously the original list didn't see him as a shoe-in. It took him for a long time to get to the, you know, the Hall of Fame. It's interesting. I don't know why. It's very, very weird.
Yeah,
but I think some of that. No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say I think some of it is that he had a reputation then as kind of a selfish player. And so
right.
his contemporaries didn't like him. He wasn't well loved by teammates. And so and with the media, not he wasn't media friendly. And so I think that he kind of suffered for that. And so he didn't get elected in the Hall of Fame until later. We, you know, it's that addition by subtraction. And so I think he's become incredibly forgotten in the history of the NBA. And not until you look at the numbers and kind of watch the film again, do you appreciate how he played and his efficiency doing so.
Yeah, and you know, I've come across a couple of articles sort of trying to explain the Adrian Dantley phenomenon. There's one at A Screaming Comes Across the Court, blogspot.com, that it's some interesting, you know, sort of observations using stats and stuff, and basically sort of concluding that, you know, Dantley was just a little bit one dimensional. He was once a great rebounder, but kind of lost that, especially in Utah, where he was just, you know, offering scoring and not much else. Didn't really pass or defend. He was just kind of like, give him the ball and get out of the way. Didn't really play off other players. But, you know, even if we accept that he was kind of one dimensional, and I remember a few years ago, and I couldn't find it again. I kind of scoured everywhere. I thought it was on, APBR, but I can't find it there, where there was like sort of like a study looking at, like, it wasn't exactly like plus minus or on off, but it was something kind of along those lines that was kind of like looking at like the effect of Dantley on his teammates, or the effect of Dantley like when he was and wasn't on the floor, and basically sort of concluding that like teams generally played better when he was off the court, generally played better when he wasn't there. But you would just think that even if you accept, okay, he wasn't good at these things, he was really one-dimensional or somewhat one-dimensional, he was such an efficient scorer at that volume that you would think that that would just in and of itself, that value would be enough to make him at least, you know, a pretty good contender for the top 50, if not in it. And you know, he was considered for the top 50. I mean, I think he was on, you know, they did like a next 10 list, and I believe he was on that. So, I mean, you know, people saw him as close to it, but you know, I mean, yeah, I mean the numbers are so good, and at least, you know, from what I can see looking at video and stuff, you know, I mean, he seemed really good. You know, he didn't seem like necessarily a huge liability on defense, at least compared to like, you know, his era. I mean, there were a lot of small forwards during his era that didn't play much defense, so you know, he wasn't like the only guy you know, in that club. So I don't know, I think he's a pretty good candidate for the top 50.
Yep.
So how do you reconcile though and you mentioned it earlier, being traded five times in his career? It's, you know, he's rookie of the year in 77, and then he ends up within three seasons he's on four teams. And so if there's that value, why is everybody getting rid of him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, He went to Buffalo and then was in Indiana for like 20 games and then went to Lakers for about two seasons. And, you know, Buffalo and Indiana were pretty dysfunctional situations at the time. The Lakers, you know, they had Jamal Wilkes, who, you know, he was kind of competing against. And, you know, so he wasn't really, you know, like, I don't know. That's like blaming Chauncey Billups for, like, you know, for bouncing around early in his career. I mean, obviously, like, once he found the right spot, like, it wasn't like he was traded a whole lot again. I mean, he went from, you know, Utah to Detroit and then, you know, Detroit to Dallas. But, I mean, those trades all kind of made sense at the time. I mean, I think if, like, you take out that early 3 years of his career when it was just, like, he wasn't really established and he was part of, like, an NBA culture that didn't necessarily like value him that well, even though, you know, like I said, he was the rookie of the year in Buffalo, but they were kind of selling everything off at that point, I think. And they obviously were, you know, close to a couple years away from moving. So I don't necessarily think the early stuff, it's fair to necessarily judge him. I think, you know, like later on you can kind of, you know, there's some conclusions you can kind of make maybe, but I think you kind of have to consider where he was in his career to kind of give that a little bit of context.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that I'm going to kind of have trouble with or wrestle with a little bit with Dantley, is that here's a guy who, you know, in a modern era, or even, you know, a few years later, or maybe 10, 15 years after his career was kind of over, he's a guy who I think would be, you know, in today's game, people would love him. I mean, the advanced stat, people would obviously enjoy the efficiency and all that sort of stuff, where you look at it then and you see that it's not much of a value, and maybe he can be seen as selfish, and, you know, he's not. That's it's very interesting, yeah, because I don't know how we – it's going to be a problem because we've ran into this with a few players that we've talked about of sort of judging them in their era, judging them all time, judging them of how we, you know, judge players and evaluate players today versus how they judged and evaluated them then and looked at. So it's really weird. I mean, real quick here, you're looking at his advanced stats, you know, based off position and based off era. Era in position, he's ninth in points per 36, sixth in free throws attempted per 36, eighth in win shares per 48, fifth in win shares and eighth in value of a replacement player. Rather, what I think is a little bit more impressive for him is position all time. So this is all time, of his position. 15th in points per 36, 11th in win shares per 48, 11th in win shares, and 19th in value of a replacement player. So we look at a lot of the advanced stats that we look at today, and he looks like a slam dunk candidate for a top 50. But then, like as Adam said, you sort of have to wrestle with the idea that, yeah, I mean, if now we think he was really good, but then they didn't think so. How do you judge that? I don't know. I have a tough time with that. I don't know if I have an exact answer of how you sort of judge those guys who maybe weren't as appreciated in their era. Do we sort of appreciate them more now or realize they were against their, you know, how the game was played at the time? I don't know. I don't know how to do that, really.
Yeah, it's complicated. I think he has a strong enough resume that he's certainly a contender, but he's probably going to be like in that, you know, those last five guys that we're going to really wrestle with. I guess we're going to put them side by side and just sort of, see where they meet stats wise and career accomplishment wise and that kind of thing. But it's, yeah, it'll, but I think he belongs in the battle for sure.
No, I agree. One all-time, like, what-if team I would have loved to see on League Pass back in the day. So in 1979, he ends up he's in Utah, right? And that same season they had Adrian Dantley, Bernard King, and Pete Maravich on the same team for, like, 3 months. And that would have been one that I would have loved to see. I talk about, you know, offensive juggernaut that they could have had for a few months there, but it wasn't to be.
Yeah, and him with Jamal Wilkes and Kareem, would have been interesting, interesting as well. It's just so weird how it is weird the early year, and you know the other guys like that, like Bernard King, you know, bounced around quite a bit too. His Buffalo Braves team. I mean, he had there was Ernie DiGregorio, Moses Malone, Bob McAdoo, Randy Smith. Those guys were all on that team. I'm not sure if they were all exactly in the same team because Moses only played two games there. So I'm guessing they probably didn't all play, you know, all on the floor quite exactly at the same time. There were some trades going on there, but still, that team had, that was an interesting mix of guys too. He played on some interesting teams before he settled there into Utah, and those Utah teams were kind of fun too. They took that team, you know, took that team 10 years to get to the playoffs, but you know they had kind of had some fun things going on for a while as well. So yeah, I wonder even if he had played 10 years later if like his Utah years would be better appreciated because that's all that stuff kind of gets forgotten because that's really before the NBA became huge. And the stuff that's remembered from the early 80s is really Lakers, Celtics, Sixers, and that's about it. So that sort of might be, he might not be as remembered quite as well as he should be because that stuff wasn't documented as well as it would have been even 10 years later. So Adam, anything else?
No, I think you're spot on. I think the numbers seem to indicate that Dantley's in the conversation, but I think ultimately end of the day, he's probably outside looking in.
All right. Well, Adam, thanks for joining us, and we'll be back again soon with more top 50 podcasts as we keep going through the candidates until we reach the finish line. Thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at harvardpressism.com. We also have our forums, as I mentioned, at overandbacknba.com. You can leave us a rating and review on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at overandbacknba. So until next time, thanks for listening.